This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
Welcome back to Radio Eco Shock. Not a week goes by without a new, strange, and dangerous threat emerging out of the shadowy future. We start with the biggest underreported story. Unseen by land mammals like ourselves, the world's oceans are heating up. That determines the future and the new coastlines for hundreds of years to come. We'll talk with Dr. Kevin Trenberth, one of the world's top climate scientists. Did you know great rivers of fresh water are traveling around the world, hidden in the consumer products we buy? Environmental journalist Stephen Leahy explains his new book, Your Water Footprint. Then Rob Aldrich says, yes, there is a growing health crisis in the Western world. You can see it all around you. And the cause is nature deficit disorder. It's Radio EcoShock. Not sure about global warming? Here's a little fact that should grab your attention. According to scientists at the University of Hawaii, the world's oceans are hotter than they have ever been in recorded history. It's a dangerous trend, and you and I may have triggered that fever. We have one of the world's top climate scientists joining us now. Dr. Kevin Trenberth is a transplanted New Zealander. He's now the Distinguished Senior Scientist in the Climate Analysis Section at the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. His advice in science is cited all over the world. Kevin, thank you for taking the time to join us.
You're most welcome.
According to news reports, water off New England is warming faster than almost anywhere on Earth. Why is that, and what does it mean?
Off of New England, the North Atlantic has certainly been warm in recent years. And this has been a factor in some of the hurricane activity and the nature of the hurricane activity that has occurred in the Atlantic. But it's probably a transient of some sort or the other, something that occurs on a decadal time frame. And we think part of the reason the North Atlantic is as warm as it is actually stems back to some of the actions in the Pacific Ocean through what atmospheric scientists call teleconnections, large waves in the atmosphere that have been associated with actually cooler conditions in Europe at that time. And so the main cold outbreaks that occurred in a number of recent years have been in Europe rather than over the North Atlantic. And as a result, the North Atlantic has been more benign and the temperatures have warmed up there.
What about the west coast of North America? Are Pacific currents warmer than usual, and have you heard about impacts on marine species off the coast?
Well, that's certainly true this year, and so things have warmed up considerably. There's been quite a substantial change in the weather patterns this year, and normally, I haven't heard any particular information about this, but normally that kind of pattern is very adverse for a salmon fishery, for instance. So the colder California current is not as active. The upwelling of nutrients and minerals that are really helpful for many fish. And there are certain kinds of species of fish that migrate a lot further north than they normally would. And I have seen some news reports of that sort of thing. And so, indeed, this does have consequences for the fisheries.
Kevin, is it possible ocean heating off North America could be balanced by ocean cooling in other parts of the globe?
Well, that's certainly true. I mean, that's what generally happens around the world, and we see that in the sea level record and also when we look in detail at the ocean temperature record. So up until the end of 2013, all of the warm water was tending to pile up across near the Philippines and the Western Pacific. And in fact, that was a factor in the big super typhoon that occurred in November of last year called Haiyan that did tremendous amounts of damage. And the warm waters over the western side were also a factor in the fairly active hurricane season this year. But there's a developing El Nino, and I think we're actually really in El Nino conditions. And that has altered conditions throughout the tropics and subtropics, and is also having an influence up the west coast of North America. And so there was a very active hurricane season in the eastern Pacific this year. One of the consequences of that was the two hurricanes or tropical storms that went through Hawaii. And there was a couple of tropical storms that did a little right-hand hook and went, they missed California, but they went into Arizona. And that's the sort of thing we expect to see when we have these warm conditions out in the Pacific.
So is there a global trend in ocean temperatures, and how confident are we in the data?
Well, yes, the overall global temperatures are increasing, and perhaps the best measure of that is the global sea level. And so sea level has been rising at a rate of 3.2 millimeters per year since 1992. 1992 is when NASA and the French launched a satellite into space that is now using an altimeter to measure the sea level, the global sea level, at millimeter accuracy. Previously, we only had sea level measurements at the coast and at island stations, but now we have a true global sea level, and since then, it's been going up at an average rate of 3.2 millimeters per year. So 3.2 millimeters per year, if you think of your ruler, a 12-inch ruler is about 30 centimeters, and so this is a rate of a little over a foot per century. And that comes about through two processes. One of them is the ocean is getting warmer, and so it's expanding. And then the second part is that there's melting of Greenland and glaciers on land that's putting more water into the ocean. And so the warming ocean and the rising sea level is, in fact, a big symptom of the, what we call global warming, the overall climate change that has a strong human component to it.
Now, a few scientists suggest this ocean heating may signal the end of the alleged hiatus in global warming. First of all, do you agree there has been a pause in warming? And second, does this imply a new warm spell is arriving?
Well, yes. If you look at the global mean surface temperature, it has more ups and downs than the global sea level record, for instance. So global sea level has continued to rise. Arctic sea ice has continued to melt, for instance, but there has been the so-called pause in the global mean surface temperature. However, it looks like 2014 will be the warmest year on record by the time we get to the end of the year. It's certainly true through the first 10 months of the year. And it won't break the previous record by very much, but it's a symptom of the fact that the oceans are warm and global warming is really continuing. You know, part of this is distorted a little bit by the huge El Nino event that we had in 1997-98. So 1998 was the warmest year last century. And so if you start looking at the record with that extremely warm year that resulted in part because a lot of heat came out of the ocean, then it makes it look like it hasn't warmed that much since that time. But 1998 was really the exceptional year. What's been going on in the 2000s is actually not that far from what we might have expected. And so the 2000s certainly are a lot warmer than the 1990s. And, you know, this warming is really continuing. So this hiatus, so-called, it looks like that could be over, although it's a bit hard to tell given that this El Nino is with us. And so it's a bit hard to tell whether it's a one-year spike or whether it will really continue. But certainly conditions are very different now than they have been over the last decade or so.
Kevin Trenberth, what about your home grounds in the southern oceans around Australia, New Zealand, and the South Pole? Are oceans warming there as well?
Ah, that's a good question. And of course, the Arctic sea ice has been melting an enormous amount, but Antarctic sea ice, if anything, has increased a little bit and spread out. But the dynamics of what goes on there is very, very different, and it relates very much to the changes in the winds. And so there have been substantial changes in winds over the southern hemisphere, that have led to very dry conditions in Australia, for instance, and a lot of heat waves and wildfires are partly as a consequence. But the change in winds, one of the things that does is it tends to carry the sea ice away from Antarctica in a number of areas. And Antarctica is cold, and so this just generates more sea ice in behind it. But a lot of that sea ice is very thin, so the volume of sea ice is, we don't really know. We don't have good measurements to know exactly what the volume is doing, but the sea ice is spread out a little bit. And so the southern oceans don't appear to have warmed as much as other parts of the oceans. But, you know, given the presence of Antarctica nearby and the sea ice, you know, maybe that's not so surprising.
Yeah, it seems like it's almost polar opposites. We have the winds seemingly loosening up, certainly the jet stream meandering in the northern hemisphere, and yet tightening around the South Pole. And that's, I guess, because of the difference between a land mass in the center of the pole and an ocean in the center of the pole.
That's partly true. So in the northern hemisphere, the sea ice is limited. It can't expand beyond the Arctic Ocean much in the wintertime. And so what we see is the big losses in the summer, whereas over the southern oceans, the sea ice is unlimited, but it can spread out, but it can also be quite thin. But another important factor between the two hemispheres has been the ozone hole. And so the ozone hole has been a big factor in contributing to a really strong, you know, a polar vortex, I'm going to say it. It's sort of in the vernacular now, but there's a very strong circumpolar set of westerly winds in the southern hemisphere that is partly caused by the loss of ozone. And so that's, for the most part, a separate problem relative to global warming, but it's contributed to some of the changes and is probably one of the factors in the differences between the two hemispheres as well.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. Our guest is the distinguished scientist Kevin Trenberth from the Climate Analysis Section at the USA National Center for Atmospheric Research. Do warmer oceans change the amount of water in the atmosphere, the hydrological cycle of rains and snows?
Oh, very much so. So the sea surface temperatures have warmed since the 1970s by about 1 degree Fahrenheit or thereabouts. And going along with that, the normal expectation, 1 degree increase in temperature of the atmosphere produces an increase in the water holding capacity by about 4%. Now, the actual atmosphere is probably warmed by, just a slight bit more than the ocean has. And so the estimate is that over the global ocean since the 1970s, there's about 4% more moisture in the atmosphere. So this means the relative humidity has stayed about the same, but there's more moisture in the atmosphere. And so this fuels hurricanes and tropical storms. It means the storms are a bit more active as a consequence. And of course, this moisture gets caught up in any storm, and it then contributes to much heavier snows in coastal regions. And in general, much heavier rainfalls are occurring across North America. So especially east of the Rockies, there's been a substantial increase in heavy rainfalls because of the increased moisture that's getting into the atmosphere associated with this warming.
You've been a lead author for the IPCC. Do we know how much warming caused by human greenhouse gases has gone into the Earth's oceans?
Well, the IPCC is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And so the IPCC does an assessment overall of the literature and how everything sort of hangs together and is also consistent with our expectations relating to climate models. And so it also has to wrangle with all of the aspects of natural variability. And so what we find in recent years is that the changes in the wind patterns, especially over the Pacific, seem to have altered the way in which the atmosphere and the ocean interacts. And so some of the heat that is normally going into the ocean has gone a bit deeper into the ocean. And as a result, it doesn't have quite as much influence on the surface temperatures. This is one of the factors in what we talked about just a minute ago on the so-called hiatus. And so some of the heat, it doesn't mean that the planet isn't heating up. It just means that the heat is going into somewhat different places. So some of it's gone into melting glaciers. glaciers and rising sea level. Some of it's gone into Arctic sea ice, and some of it's gone into a little bit deeper into the ocean. But one of the consequences of that is that sea level rise is continuing. And in that sense, sea level rise is perhaps a better indicator overall that global warming is continuing.
Is there a limit, Kevin Trenberth, to how much heat the oceans can buffer for us?
Well, the oceans are warm on top and cold down below. The deep oceans are very cold, and so that's a stable configuration. The main way in which the oceans get mixed up is when in the wintertime, especially off the east coast of Asia and North America, so this is where the Kuroshio Current and the Gulf Stream Current in the Atlantic occur, and when this very cold, dry air coming off the continent, the continents in wintertime, it can cool off the surface ocean, and then when the surface ocean is cool, that cold air sinks, and so convection occurs in the ocean. So the ocean is the sort of the opposite of the atmosphere. In the atmosphere, we have warming that triggers convection, but in the ocean, it's cooling. And so there has been a mixing of the ocean that generally occurs partly on a seasonal basis because of the wintertime cooling. And we talked a little bit before about the North Atlantic, the fact that the North Atlantic hasn't experienced as much of these cold outbreaks in recent times means that the convection has not been as active in the North Atlantic, and the oceans have warmed at multiple levels as a consequence of that. So it's very difficult to pump heat down in the ocean. The ocean tends to warm and create a more stable configuration. That also means that there's less mixing in general in the oceans, and this has consequences for all of the organisms in the ocean and the amount of oxygen that's available for fish and other species. And so this more stable configuration in the oceans is a bit worrying. But mixing by winds is one way in which the ocean can indeed warm up, and changes in ocean currents, which also, you know, run up against obstacles in the ocean, islands, coastal regions, and things like that. There can be some deeper mixing that occurs in association with that kind of thing as well. So it's a bit hard to get the oceans to warm up, but some of the changes we've seen in the last decade do mean that some deeper parts of the ocean are warming a bit more than they did before.
So water takes a long time to heat and a long time to cool off. Kevin, am I right to think these hotter oceans could lead to a warming world for centuries, even after we kick the carbon habit?
That would be certainly true. And, of course, this is one of the worries. The oceans are not in equilibrium with our climate system. They're not in equilibrium with the warming. We expect warming of the oceans to occur even if we were to shut off increases in carbon dioxide and the other agents for warming that are occurring in the atmosphere. And sea level rise is apt to continue for maybe even hundreds of years after if we shut off any other warming that occurs. And so there's a very slow adjustment of the oceans as the heat slowly penetrates deeper into the ocean. And so what we're doing now has consequences for decades and even centuries into the future. And this is why scientists are quite concerned, very concerned about the global warming phenomenon. You know, by the time maybe the general public recognizes that it's a serious problem, it's a bit too late to do very much about it, because a lot of it's going to continue regardless, and we will then have to live with the consequences. So this is one of the clarion calls of scientists, that we need to worry about the fact that the oceans respond in a very slow and sluggish fashion.
As we wrap up, I have one last question for you. As you know, North Americans have been hit by crazy weather, a super Arctic chill, giant snowstorms, and then spring-like days. Do you agree with Dr. Jennifer Francis that destabilized weather may be linked to the huge annual meltback of Arctic sea ice?
I'm not entirely sure about that. I mean, part of that may well be a consequence. You know, a good example is what just happened recently in November. It seems to me that the sequence of events was that we actually had a super typhoon called Nuri that developed in the western Pacific. It went through Japan and caused quite a bit of damage. But then it became a hybrid storm, much like Superstorm Sandy, and it developed and became a very intense and huge storm in the North Pacific. And it turns out the central pressure in that storm was the lowest on record. And so that storm kept heading north up into Alaska and even into the Arctic, and it carried a tremendous amount of warm air with it that went right up into the Arctic. And so the Arctic was exceptionally warm in the first 2 to 3 weeks of November. And of course, that pushed the cold air somewhere else. And where did the cold air come? Well, it came down barreling right across North America. And so the cold outbreak was actually coupled to the warm air outbreak that occurred. And so this is one of the complications with regard to the Arctic. There's certainly been a loss of Arctic sea ice, and that no doubt has some influences, especially on the surrounding areas, Siberia, the Canadian regions, and so on. And it affects snowfall, like there's a lake effect snowfall kind of activity that occurs as a consequence of more open Arctic ocean. But, you know, by the time you get to late November and into December, the Arctic is basically full of ice. And so the losses of sea ice in the summertime don't have a big effect as we get into the deep winter. And I think most of what's going on with regard to the Arctic is then more a consequence rather than a cause of what is going on across the world.
There you have it. In a complex world, I'm Alex Smith from the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. We've been talking with the senior climate scientist, Kevin Trenberth. Thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
You're most welcome.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Either you have enough water or you don't. Life of all kinds depends upon the answer to that question. Along with farmers, all big cities wrestle with water issues, and some of that precious water disappears half a world away to make products that we buy. That's all in a new book, Your Water Footprint, The Shocking Facts About How Much Water We Use to Make Everyday Products. It's by the professional environmental journalist Stephen Leahy. We have him on the line now. Steve, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. I'm happy to be here.
So your new book takes us places I didn't expect. Just the cover is shocking. Really, does it take 240 gallons of water to make a modern mobile phone? How is that possible?
Well, there's a lot of parts to a mobile phone. We've got microchips, you've got metals, you've got plastic, you've got batteries, you've got silica glass. There's lots of parts to it, and it takes water to make all of those parts. It's one of the things I learned in researching his book, is it takes water to make everything.
All right. Another factoid that interested me, how much water does it take to make a cup of coffee from one of those big coffee chains?
Yeah, that takes about 37 gallons or 140 liters of water. So that most of that water is for the growing of the coffee beans. You know, it's a tropical plant, and it takes a lot of water to grow the beans, but also a fair amount of processing and, of course, transport from tropical areas also uses water in the form of the fuel that it takes to get it to your cup.
Well, you know, I just got a funny image of, if we wanted to be real about this, we should take in a cup that will hold 140 liters or 37 gallons, and then we'd realize what we're buying at the store. And what about the clothes we wear? Are we soaking up the water with that too?
Yeah, I mean, I'm probably wearing about 20,000 liters of water right now. And that's basically, you know, a pair of pants, a shirt, a sweatshirt, and some socks, and a pair of shoes. That's how much water it takes to make all of those materials.
It is amazing. So how were you able to calculate these amounts of water used for different consumer products?
Well, I used a research based out of a university in the Netherlands called the University of Twente. And they are the pioneers of the whole water footprint concept. And so they've developed analytical tools to determine how much water it takes to make things. And so I use all their research as a baseline for all of the numbers in the book.
Are there other crazy water-intensive products that maybe we should avoid?
You know, that's actually a hard question to answer because it all depends on how they're made and where they're made. So it's more complicated than I would have liked the issue to be. But I think one thing that is key for listeners to understand is disposable products, basically disposable anything, ends up having a much greater water footprint. So one example I give in the book is disposable diapers versus cloth diapers. So a cloth diaper, 4 gallons, disposable diaper, 144 gallons. Why such a big difference? Well, you're reusing the cloth diaper over and over again, and the amount of water it takes to wash the diaper isn't that much in comparison to the amount of water it takes to make a disposable diaper, which has, you know, basically wood pulp and a bunch of other fibers that requires a lot of water to produce.
Well, that makes sense. You know, Steve, I remember Lester Brown of World Watch saying countries don't export wheat, they export the water used to grow it. And places like Australia can hardly afford to do that. Talk to us about the water trade involved in globalized agriculture.
Yeah, that's an enormous volume of water basically flowing from Australia to other countries. Australia is the biggest exporter of what's called virtual water, so water and food products in the world, and it's the driest continent in the world. And, you know, this is kind of one of those things when you go, that doesn't really make sense, and it doesn't. But this is also the case in other countries. Other countries like Egypt ship thousands and thousands of pounds of oranges to Europe. And, of course, Egypt is a very dry country. Oranges require a lot of water. You know, should they be doing that, growing that crop instead of providing food for their own people? One way to envision this, it's not just food products. It's also other types of products. So China is shipping enormous volumes of water in the form of electronics and, I don't know, furniture and other products to the U.S. and Canada. So if you imagine this huge, huge river of water flowing out of China into Canada and the U.S., it's an incredible number, and it's in the book. But this is something that we, I think, need to get a grip on, these huge virtual water flows between countries.
Yeah, and China, parts of northern China are drying up. The Gobi Desert is expanding. Desertification is a big problem there. Plus, they have very little fresh water left, so much of it is polluted. So it's a big issue. Now, is fast food part of the problem?
It can be. It doesn't have to be. It all depends on where the food is grown and what food is being sold. So some foods, such as burgers, so beef, is very water intensive. It's, you know, 4,000 or 5,000gallons of water per kilogram, so 2 pounds of beef. So it's one of those really heavy water use. But it all depends on where it's grown and what they're offering. So it's not quite as clear as saying fast food is bad.
All right. Now, I have to question this a little bit. It seems like there is a lot of water in the world. Isn't there enough? Stephen Leahy, how do you know there really is a water problem?
Yeah, it looks like it, at least when you're in Canada. If you're in California, perhaps you don't see it the same way. So we've got the droughts in California, and we've got droughts throughout the Sahel and Africa. There's droughts in many, many places in the world. Statistically, people are looking at all the numbers of water and consumption of water, and continually, we're running into this sort of water shortage. So about 1.2 billion people face chronic water shortages right now. There's another 2.5 billion who occasionally face water shortages. So we're getting more and more people are being affected by water shortages. And there really isn't that much fresh water in the world. It's only a tiny percentage of all the water on the entire planet.
So it's hard to picture the lives of people who face water shortages. We see images of women walking a few miles with containers that they're carrying with water. It's hard to imagine those lives where just getting water is a big part of your day.
Yeah, I mean, only about half of the world has access to piped water, so water being piped into where they're living. So the other half of the world have to haul it from wells or streams. And about 20% of all the people in the world, they don't actually have access to clean water. So they're having to drink and cook with, you know, very bad water that makes them sick on a regular basis.
Yeah. So on our current path, what are experts predicting for the year 2050?
Well, they're predicting pretty dire scenarios when it comes to water. Even by 2025, which isn't that far away now, 3 in 5 people will be facing water shortages, the experts predict. You know, because we have to remember that we use water for energy production. All forms of energy need water. We use water, of course, for food and for all of our products. So So as the numbers of people in terms of population grow, as well as consumption grows, we're using more and more water. And, you know, we're already having hit the limit in many places. You know, California being a good example of a place that's already having its water bubble burst.
Yeah, it reminds me that fracking is kind of a water crime. They take mountains and mountains of water, poison it essentially, and then inject it into the deep earth, we hope, to get rid of it. So it's a way of getting rid of fresh water. This is Radio EcoShock. My guest is environmental journalist Stephen Leahy. We're talking about his surprising new book, Your Water Footprint. Stay tuned for more on your impact on water shortages in faraway countries and nature deficit disorder. Welcome back. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, with more on the hidden international transfer of valuable water. Then we'll ask, how would I know if I had nature deficit disorder? And what can we do about it?
Radio EcoShock.
There's been a lot of news about millions of people, Steve, in Sao Paulo, Brazil, almost running out of water. Their aquifer is threatened for some reason. Do you know anything about the situation there?
Well, I know a little bit about it. There's been a long term problem of decreasing rainfall in southern Brazil, and this has been linked to the deforestation of the Amazon rainforest. So the Amazon produces its own weather, if you like, and it's been responsible for providing rain to the southern parts of Brazil for thousands of years. But so much of it has been cut away that it can no longer perform this function, and it's one of the reasons why Sao Paulo is suffering right now.
And in the United States, more millions of people depend on that big underground reserves in the Ogallala Aquifer. People joke about that, saying certain states would dry up and blow away without it. How big is the Ogallala, and is it possible that could run out someday?
It is really big. It's one of the world's biggest water bodies, although it's underground. It's about contains the volume of Lake Huron, so that's something like 866 cubic miles. It's an enormous, resource. I think it's the second or third largest or underground aquifer, but it's being depleted 14 times faster than it can recharge. Now it's 14 times faster, and it's dropping about 9 feet every year. By 2030, 2035, there isn't going to be much water left in it, a recent study showed.
Well, I suppose after reading your book, it would be handy if every product label stated the amount of water consumed in making it along with the energy used in it. Do you see that day coming?
Not really. It's difficult to do labeling on products, you know, specific numbers. They could say this might be a water smart product, and I think that would be helpful in the sense that it's grown in a place where the water is being used sustainably. Now that, you know, something like a green labeling would be, I think, very helpful, because otherwise it's very confusing or very complicated for people to be able to figure this out.
I agree. Now, Stephen Leahy, I know you've covered international environment meetings for years. Are scientists or leaders starting to be concerned with this hidden global water trade in consumer products?
They are. They are in the sense that they call it the nexus. This is the new buzzword in that field. The combination of increasing consumption, increasing population, increasing need for more energy, all of this means increased water use. And now we're in an era of climate change, which makes rainfall much less predictable. We get too much water where we don't need it and not enough where we do. This is seen to be probably the biggest issue we're going to have to come to grips along with climate change this century.
Yeah, I know. As you say, scientists say the world's deserts will expand even as wet places get heavier deluges. What can local communities do to improve their water resilience?
I think one of the things they need to understand is, you know, what is the sustainable capacity of our water system that we have, our water basin, our underground resources? You know, really need to have that sort of baseline. What's the recharge rates? How much water can we actually use on a sustainable basis? And a lot of places don't have any idea about that. Places like even in California, there's no rules about pumping groundwater out of the ground. Anybody can sink a well and suck up as much water as they like. So we need to understand, also to value our water resources and then protect them. Now, protect them means protecting the riparian areas, so the wetlands and the forest areas that keep our water clean and actually help us prevent floods. They can hold water during dry periods so that we'll still continue to have fresh water when we need it.
Yeah, my broadcast studio is in a desert-like area. We actually have some wild cactus growing outside. And yet people have lawns and they keep pumping and pumping and pumping water. It's almost like a contest to see who can have the greenest lawns. And I'm hoping that will change. I know Las Vegas, for example, has started buying back lawns that give you money for what you convert to a real sustainable landscape that fits where it is. You know, one of the things I wonder is how can we help as global citizens? Can you give us a few tips from your new book?
Yeah, the book has quite a few suggestions. Certainly, the starting point is to value and appreciate the fact that we need water for everything, and then to think about things like diet. A meat diet uses a lot more water than a vegetarian diet, so that's just the simple fact of what it takes to grow and produce. So you could reduce your daily water use by about 1,300 liters or roughly 400 gallons a day just by switching to a vegetarian diet. Another good suggestion, I think, is this Meatless Mondays. It's just become quite trendy. That's a big, for a family of four, that would save enormous amounts of water, 200, 300,000 gallons a year. Another thought is, the 3 R's, the good old 3 R's, reduce, reuse, recycle. And this is especially true, of course, for products. Clothing, go to the thrift stores. Take your clothes to the thrift store. We all have closets full of clothes that are just sitting there. Those are all sort of practical, useful things. I mean, it's really, water use is connected to consumption of energy, consumption of products, and consumption of food. One of the things about food is that we waste about 30 to 40% of our food in North America. And obviously, that means all the water that it took to grow that, we're also wasting.
Steve, one of the things I love about your new book, it isn't pages of type. I just wasn't ready for another long read. This one's loaded with maps and graphs, and it takes us right to that key information visually, quickly. It's one of the books that's going right beside my desk where I can grab it for a reference. Listeners, you can look in the usual places for this book, Your Water Footprint, the shocking facts about how much water we use to make everyday products. You can follow the writings of Stephen Leahy at his website, stephenleahy.net. Stephen has a PH in it, and Leahy is spelled L-E-A-H-Y. Steve, can you tell us about a couple of stories you're working on now?
Yeah, I'm working on toxic pollution sites in the developing world. So around the developing world, there are hundreds of thousands of toxic polluted sites. I mean, a lot of countries who are in their rapid growth to industrialization are using a lot of old technology that we used to use that are highly polluting. Cleaning them up is difficult. There's a huge impact on people's health. And that's going to affect the ability of these countries to develop. So that's a huge problem. It's probably going to be, I think, a major issue in the next decade when people begin to realize the seriousness of it.
Yeah, in the States, people still remember Love Canal. It was where all sorts of toxic chemicals were dumped. And there are Superfund sites around the United States. But I'm imagining that they're probably nothing compared to what's happening in the developing world as we make these quickie consumer products with very toxic production facilities. And we may have toxic hotspots that won't be inhabitable or people will be sick wherever they do live around them for a century or two to come. It's sad to think about that.
Yeah, it is. And, that's exactly right. And so this is, I think, another one of the big pressing problems that we have to face. Of course, the other one I'm working on is the upcoming climate change conference in Lima, Peru, which is the UN meetings to form a new international climate change treaty.
Well, we kind of throw our hands up about those climate meetings. They don't seem to do anything. And yet there is public pressure building on these leaders. It's becoming more politically acceptable, in some countries at least, to talk about it. Do you see any hope for this? Are we going to get any international action in this decade?
Yeah, we will definitely get the action. We will get action. We won't get the action we need, unfortunately, without a lot of public pressure. It's really going to take people marching in the streets as they did in New York in September and other cities around the world. It's going to take more of that kind of public push to get us to take the necessary actions to avert a climate catastrophe. I mean, there are other countries that actually figured this out, and like Germany is moving along really quickly. There's no disagreement at any political level by any party, that they're going to be zero carbon as soon as possible. And they want to develop the technology and the jobs as fast as possible because they know this is the future. And they're going to be well ahead of many other countries, namely Canada and the U.S., because they'll have all the technologies and the expertise, and we're going to have to buy it from them.
Well, there you have it, StephenLahey.net. I can't tell you the number of times that I've read a story of Steve's, and then about 6 months later, it becomes big news in the mainstream media. So that's a good place to tune in if you are concerned about the environment. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
We all know there's a health crisis in America, as in many other parts of the industrial world. It isn't just diet or lack of exercise. According to a new declaration, we are so far away from the environment, it is making us sick. It's called nature deficit disorder. It's real, and here to talk about it is Rob Aldrich, the Community Conservation Director for the Land Trust Alliance in Washington, D.C. Rob, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
So how would I know if I was suffering from nature deficit disorder?
Well, Alex, nature deficit disorder is a term coined by Richard Louv in his 2005 book, Last Child in the Woods. And it's not a formal disorder recognized in medical manuals of mental disorders. But what it is he's found that with humans, especially children, that are spending less time outdoors and more time indoors with watching TV or on other computer equipment, that behavior leads to a host of problems with the kids, attention deficit disorder, and other problems with children. So if you had that, you would be more hyperactive. You would have lower grades in school. You would probably be more of a problem behaviorally for your parents and teachers.
Well, when you think about it, we evolved over, about 100,000 years at least to look at long distances, to see green things, to watch out for what's happening in trees. And now we're on couches, in chairs, and as you say, looking on little screens. It's quite a shift.
Yes, and I was actually a little bit dismayed to hear that a little piece in a newspaper for a maximum security prison where prisoners get 1 hour outside of their cells, that they were actually showing those prisoners pictures of nature scenes, waterfalls and trees and greenery, and they said it had a positive impact on the prisoners. So even simulated images of nature are good for our mind and our bodies.
That reminds me of one of the last scenes in Soylent Green, the sci-fi movie, where, again, as you head out of this world, you're shown pictures of the nature that once was. But, you know, I read your press release. Isn't it a bit over the top to say this is a national health crisis?
Oh, not at all, Alex. If you look at the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, has something that they call, that they're tracking the obesity epidemic in the United States. It's called the Behavioral Risk Factor Surveillance System. And it's just stunning. If you could see slides of the U.S. where they color in states that are less than 10% of the population of the state is obese, or they go from 0 to 14%. And then from 1985 to 2010, it is just amazing the number of states that have gone from less than 10% to greater than or equal to 30% of their population is overweight. And by overweight, that's about 30 pounds for a person who's 5'4". So we definitely have an obesity epidemic in the United States. And obesity is important because it leads to other health problems like asthma, joint pain, hypertension, things like that. So obesity just isn't one thing. It's a kind of an indicator for a lot of other health problems.
Well, and aside from shortening lives, rotten health is costing the economy and families billions of dollars. Do we know how much, did you calculate how much this separation from nature could be costing us?
We haven't done that, but there is a land trust in Alabama called the Freshwater Land Trust, and the executive director of that is Wendy Jackson, and she's just a mover and a shaker and a force of nature. But she has done work with the University of Alabama at Birmingham, and they did a survey of people in Jefferson County and who were physically inactive. And 19% of the physically inactive said that they would use a nice, safe place to walk and bike at least four times per week. 39% of those who were physically inactive said they would use it at least three times per week. Based on this, using conservative numbers, the total savings for Jefferson County could be $21 million to $43 million per year if they were to provide nice, safe places to walk and bike for their residents. That's astounding.
It is. I wonder what the chances are my family doctor or a physician in a walk-in clinic would recognize that I have nature deficit disorder. They don't even ask about that, as far as I can tell.
Well, a lot don't, but there are some very promising signs. Actually, last week I had lunch with Robert Czar. He's a pediatrician here in Washington, D.C., and my communications director and I had lunch with Dr. Czar because we heard him on NPR. He's practices here in Washington, D.C., and he works with patients that are underserved. And he's just an amazing person, just full of energy. And he is doing something called Parks RX. And what he does is, with his kids that come to see him, he looks to see what they do during the day. And he's done some research on the, I think it's 340 parks in the in the Washington D.C. area, and he's rated them. He has a database that shows where the parks are, how big they are they near a bus line or a train line, how safe they are, what kind of activities can go on in that park, and what kind of layout the park is, so that when a kid comes to him, he can actually look in his database and prescribe a park. And he told us of one girl who her parents brought her in and said, "We just don't know what to do. She is just off the walls at school and at home, and we just can't control her." And so he said, "Well, you know, what do you guys, how often do you guys get outside?" And they said, "Well, not very much." And he said, "Well, what do you do on the weekends?" And they said, "Well, we stay in our house." And he said, "All right, this is what I'm going to do." He prescribed the biggest park in the D.C. area is Rock Creek Park. So he said, "You got a big problem, so I'm going to prescribe you to a big park. So I want you to take your daughter to this Rock Creek Park and just let her run around for 2 to 3 hours on Saturday and 2 to 3 hours on Sunday and see what happens." So they said, "All right, well, we can do that." And a couple of months later, she came back in with her parents for a checkup, and he went through everything, and everything looked fine. And towards the end of the visit, they were kind of puzzled, and they say, "Aren't you going to ask us, you know, if the park worked?" And he said, "Well, tell me what happened." And they said, "There's no more problems. She's fine. She's calmed down. She's not acting out. She's just much more behaved than she ever has been." And that for Dr. Czar was just amazing that he expected it, but it was an amazing proof of the impact of getting kids outside, connecting to nature. And all she did was run around. They didn't have her do, soccer or any kind of formal sports. She just explored nature with her parents.
There's no cheaper treatment than a walk in the park or a trail outdoors, but, you know, it makes me think Big Pharma isn't going to make money on that. I wonder if we'll see an overt or subterranean campaign to discredit nature deficit disorder. Have you heard criticisms of this disorder as such?
Alex, I haven't heard any criticisms, but to tell you the truth, I haven't been looking for them. I've just been so pleased with the amount of research that's coming out that's on the positive side. I haven't looked for any criticisms of it. But really, who can argue with the benefits of being outdoors? I mean, it's part of human nature. Back a while ago, who was the philosopher who talked about biophilia and how there's a theory out there that humans have an intrinsic love of life and living systems? It was actually Eric Fromm.
Was it Eric Fromm? And Edward O. Wilson, the biologist, also talked about that.
Yes, he he popularized that in 1984 in his book, and he named it biophilia. Mm-hmm. And basically, he was, you know, calling it the urge to affiliate with other forms of life. So, but it came from a philosopher from a few decades ago. And so he and Edward O. Wilson were saying that this is something that's rooted in the human psyche. And that's what I think the nature deficit disorder is with, when you disconnect humans from that connection that they need to outdoors, that's when you get problems.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Robert Aldrich from the Land Trust Alliance. So, Rob, your organization can be part of the solution. What is the Land Trust Alliance?
The Land Trust Alliance is the national leader of the nation's 1,200 land trusts. And for those that don't know what land trusts are, or they're also called land conservancies, I think they're the best-kept secret in the environmental sector. They are nonprofit groups that are locally based, and they save land in communities that's important for those communities. So they can be very big, like the Nature Conservancy. They're a world, you know, a worldwide land trust. Or they can be very small and all volunteer. And they work from Alaska to Florida and Maine to Texas. But what thing they have in common is that they are people who are dedicated to making their communities that are healthy places to live, work, and play.
You know, I last week interviewed a person who wrote a book about Ted Turner, who's the second largest property owner in the United States, and he has put some covenants on some of the giant ranches that he's purchased that make sure that they can never be subdivided or used for other purposes. That sounds like a good idea as well.
Right, and what those covenants that you talk about are also, the technical term is conservation easement, and what those are agreements that are, they're legally binding voluntary agreements between landowners and land trusts, and what it does is take that ability to develop land out of the landowner's hands. So you're right that a lot of his land, you know, beautiful, picturesque land, will never be subdivided and have little, you know, McMansions popping up out in the vast Midwest because he has put that restriction on his land. But they're beneficial for a lot of people. I mean, he's super wealthy, but farmers are also putting conservation easements on their land because, you know, a farmer, the biggest asset that a lot of them have is their land. And so when they're at the end stages of their life and they want to donate their land to their sons or daughters, a lot of them can't do that because of the inheritance taxes. And so what happens is the people, the sons and daughters who inherit that land, have to sell off a part of the land to pay for the inheritance tax. Well, if you take the development value from that farm and donate it to a land trust, then the value of the land is less and there's less of inheritance tax to pay. And so what conservation easements do and land trusts collaborating with landowners, it allows the farmer to keep the farm in the family and productive, and that has multiple benefits for the community. It has economic implications. It has water and food implications for that community. So the work that land trusts do with wealthy landowners and with not so wealthy landowners is all based on providing public benefit for that community.
So please tell us what the Wingspread Declaration is.
Well, the Wingspread Declaration is we just had a press release on that, and that is all about saying how important land conservation is for health. And it was a declaration put out by a number of organizations that are working together to promote the fact that conserving land is and having land available for people is critical to our national health.
And I gather there are big meetings in New Orleans and Australia where the declaration will be raised. What do you hope will happen with it?
The thing is that people feel this in their bones. You know that people are, you feel better when you're in a park or you're outside or, you know, with the sun shining, you have a fresh breeze on your face. That's something that you intrinsically know. But sometimes when we get wrapped up in going to work and taking the kids to soccer and paying the bills and doing all these other things, that just getting on with our lives, we don't really appreciate those basic things. And so what I hope the declaration does is kind of elevate the fact that, yes, it's very important to have nature for the very survival of humans, that it's not something that we can disregard. It's something we have to pay attention to, and we have to guard that nature so that we need nature to develop as a species and to survive as a species. So that's what I hope happens, that people appreciate nature and how valuable it is for us as humans.
This fits in with an interview I just did with Christian Schwegerl, a German environmental writer, who was saying, these days, what is nature is what we say is nature, in the sense that if we don't protect it, it all gets used. That's the way humans are going. Now, look, some people can't afford an SUV or a holiday in the mountains. Can inner city minorities like African Americans be part of this movement?
Well, that's a really good point. And I think there are organizations, it's not coming to me right now, but that are talking about the lack of African Americans visiting national parks. And I think that's where land trust can play a big role. Some land trusts call it nature nearby. But if you think about it, the population in the United States is moving towards the urban built environment. And so there's less people out where the land is, and there's more people where all the development is. And so small pocket parks, trails, river corridors, those kind of interurban green spaces are becoming more and more important. And that's really where a lot of land trusts are working. They're seeing that that people in cities need that connection to nature, and they're providing that close to where people live.
Yeah, I just had a chance to look that up on the net while you were speaking, and the organization that's working on that particular area is Outdoor Afro.
Exactly.
So people can look that one up. All right. Well, it's fantastic that we've gone so far indoors into these little packaged worlds that we need to be told, go outside and play. I think it may get worse before it gets better. What do you think, Rob, that it will take to turn this tide around?
Well, that's a good question, Alex. I think that as people look at what's happening to their kids, you know, kids are getting more obese at a younger age. They're not doing as well in school. These are basic things that people want for their kids, get a good education, to be healthy, to be happy. And I think if the idea of connecting people to nature is going to make them healthier, happier, do better in school, I think that's what's going to turn the tide, that people are going to recognize nature for the benefits that it provides us, the basic human benefits that it provides, and then they're going to fight to keep the nature close to them.
Where can our listeners go to find out more about this Wingspread Declaration and Nature Deficit Disorder?
The best place to go is healthandnature.org. That has a lot of resources. It has links to all of the organizations that have signed on to the Wingspread Declaration, and there's lots and lots of information there on the impacts of nature on health.
Okay, healthandnature.org. I'll put that link in my Radio EcoShock show blog at ecoshock.info. You can also check in to the landtrustalliance.org. Thank you so much for talking with us, Rob Altrich from Washington, D.C. and the Land Trust Alliance.
You're welcome, Alex. Thank you for having me.
I'm Alex Smith reporting for Radio EcoShock. That's it for another week of Radio EcoShock. Please support your nonprofit radio station, the people brave enough to tell it like it is. As always, you can listen again on our SoundCloud page or download any and all of our past programs for free as MP3s from the website ecoshock.org. Find links for what you've heard in this show in my weekly program blog published Wednesday at ecoshock.info. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about your world.